A human rights monitoring group estimates that over 500 people have been killed in nearly 4 months of Iranian protests.
There are many of the protesters who have been detained in the past couple of weeks. So most of them are in danger of the death sentence.
Plus, we'll have analysis on why Russia appears so eager to get more aerial weapons from Iran to use in Ukraine. And later in the program, we'll hear from Washington's Jewish Policy Center about what the U.S. and Israel are going to do to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
These sorts of cooperative activities tell the Iranians that the U.S. is serious, as well as the fact that Israel is serious.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran.
Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
And I'm Steve Miller. The U.S.-based human rights monitor, Human Rights Activist News Agency, says that 516 people have been killed in protests since they began nearly 4 months ago. And that figure also includes 70 children. In addition, the group puts the number of protesters arrested at more than 19,000, 687 of which are students. Joining us now via WhatsApp is Reza Samasi, a journalist with VOA's Persian service. Reza, as we approach this four-month mark in the protests in Iran, what have you seen in terms of their evolution as they have continued?
Well, we can say that like many other protests throughout the world, not only in Iran, after more than 3 months, a little bit calm compared to the past, especially the first 2 months. It's not just because of the new year, because of the cold season. No, it is just because people are dealing with the mourning ceremonies of those who have lost their lives during the protest. So the nature, the form of the protest has changed. So some people say that we have ups and downs and we are in the down mode. I'm not agree. The protest still alive, but in a different shape. So we have the 40th days after the death or the killing of the protesters. Many of them are teenagers and young protesters. So people mainly gather in the cemeteries on the grave of the loved ones. And many people, sometimes hundreds, sometimes, especially in the Kurdish area, thousands of people gather and they chant slogans against the regime. So we can say protests still continue.
Reza, what about the two teenagers that were just sentenced to death?
There are many of the protesters who have been detained in the past couple of weeks. So most of them are in danger of the death sentence. So the Islamic regime, the judiciary system, even the parliament members, they have called for their hangings or death sentence to be issued for them. They are accused of muharebe, waging war against guards. So this accusation could potentially bring the death sentence for many of the protesters. So the two that you have asked for, Mehdi Mohammadi Fad, he's only 18, and Mohammad Burughani, he's 19. So they were the ones who were faced with this danger. And then the death sentence for them were upheld by the Supreme Court. This is very, very concerning, especially not only for the families, not only for the people of Iran, but also for the international community, for the human rights groups. So along with this death sentence, Mohammadi Fad received some other sentences, like 6 months for propaganda, propaganda against the regime, 2 years for inciting people to murder and disrupt national security, and 1 year in prison for insulting the supreme leader of Iran. And then there were some other reports by Harana, the news agency of human rights activists. Mohammadi Fad has been denied the right to choose his lawyer. Also, Harana was quoted an informed source as saying that all his confessions had been extracted under torture and ill treatment.
Reza, we don't have much time left. With 2023 now here, you know, there have been some remarks made by influential figures in Iran. What exactly did they say, and what do you see as that having an impact on the protest movement and how the Iranian government responds as the year gets underway?
What is being called as a coordinated collective announcement by a group of the opposition figure, it was on the New Year's Eve on Saturday night by Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, by Masih Alinejad, Nazanin Bunyadi, an Iranian British actress and human rights activist, and Hamed Ismailoun, Shirin Ebadi, Ali Karimi, Golshifteh Farahani, and some other people. But when we saw these messages on Twitter, when they shared these messages simultaneously with the same exact same text. It was written, the year 2022 was a glorious year of solidarity for Iranians of every belief, language, and orientations. With organization and solidarity, 2023 will be the year of victory for the Iranian nation, the year of freedom and justice in Iran. So it was welcomed by many in the social media, by many people, political figures, activists, but at the same time, there were some criticism and some concerns because especially the political groups and political activists, they have some concerns that some of the main political figures and groups were excluded in this group. So in general, we can say the authorities try to demine the position of these figures. For instance, they said that Nazanin Bunyadi, an actress and human rights activist, does not have any social base to do such moves.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave our conversation there. Reza Salmasi is a journalist with VOA's Persian service. Reza, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having me. It's a great pleasure for me.
Visit voanews.com and click on the Iran tab at the top of the page for more updates on Iran throughout the day.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The Biden administration says it's looking at ways to target Iran's production of attack drones that it says Tehran has been providing to Moscow for ongoing Russian strikes on civilian sites in Ukraine. National Security Council spokesperson Adrienne Watson told the New York Times last week that the U.S. is seeking to restrict Iran's access to drone technologies by imposing sanctions and export controls and talking to private companies whose parts Iran already has built into drones. Sam Bendett is a Russia military analyst at the Center for a New American Security in Washington. While Russia denies using Iranian drones, Bendett told me in a phone call that evidence from Ukraine indicates otherwise.
The drones that are used to attack Ukrainian targets, Ukrainian civilian energy infrastructure, are in fact Iranian-made Shahed 136 and 131 drones. They are identical to the Iranian-made products with a Russian label on it, which suggests that Russians are either putting them together or just simply putting a Russian name over the Iranian technology. There's a lot of data and a lot of information available from the U.S. intelligence community, which is made public, about these plans, about these acquisitions, and about these intentions. And a lot of that information is coming from, again, United States, is coming from Ukraine as well. And the information that's coming suggests an ever-growing dependence by Russia on these Iranian products, not just loitering munitions, but also long-range missiles.
Why do you think Russia wants missiles from Iran in addition to drones?
Well, it needs to bolster its own stockpiles. It's clear that Russia has used a lot at this point. It's not running out per se, but it may have gone through a significant share of its long-range missiles and wants to supplement their own stockpile with additional technology from Iran. When it comes to these Shahed 136 and 131 drones, Russia doesn't have anything like that in its arsenal. It has its own loitering munitions with a very short range of around 40 kilometers. It has very few combat unmanned aerial vehicles that it's used very sparingly with a range of around 250 kilometers. Everything else that Russia has is used mostly for gathering intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance up to about 120 or so kilometers or less. And so Iran actually fills a very important technological gap in a Russian drone fleet. It gives Russia the ability to strike Ukrainian targets at a distance of up to 200 kilometers. The drones that Iran is selling to Russia or transferring are actually very cheap. The initially discussed costs are around $20,000 per drone, meaning each of the Shaheds may be even cheaper than some of the smaller and cheaper short-range air defense systems that Ukraine is using. So when it comes to doing cost-benefit analysis, Russia wins with regards to simply flying a large number of these drones at Ukrainian targets, overwhelming Ukrainian airspace, forcing Ukrainians to expand air defense ammunition. And eventually one of these drones actually penetrates the target to strike a stationary element like an energy power plant in Ukraine. And so this is a very important element in Russia's war in Ukraine today, and will probably persist as an important element going well into 2023.
What do we know about how Russia is sort of paying Iran back for all of these acquisitions? What is Iran actually getting in return?
Well, Iran and Russia have had a military technical relationship going back decades. Iran may be getting more sophisticated military equipment from Russia. There's talk of sophisticated aircraft and other elements and components. Russian and Iranian bilateral relationship was defined by their common opposition to U.S. goals and principles worldwide, not just in the Middle East, but in Eurasia and other parts of the world. So these two countries are sort of coming together as targets of opportunity at this point, because both see themselves on the same side of the fence with respect to U.S. and Western interests and Western pressure as defined by Moscow and Tehran.
Well, why do you think we aren't hearing anything officially from either Russia or Iran up to this point about what Iran is specifically receiving from the Russian side in terms of any cash payments or even transfers of technology?
Well, obviously, Russia had to pay Iran something for this drone acquisition. So that was probably a monetary payment. But there was also evidence that Iran got samples of Western military equipment used in Ukraine as also part of its payment for transferring these drones and missiles. And some of these more advanced Western examples of weapons and systems are the ones that are used by U.S. and their allies across the Middle East. So Iran is getting their hands on some of the more modern, updated, and sophisticated technology, as well as the obvious cash payments.
Why do you think Iran is continuing down this path of closer military cooperation with Russia, despite the West imposing more and more sanctions on it for doing so?
Well, both countries are learning from each other. In fact, there was an event recently with Iranian and Russian scientists discussing their mutual cooperation and ways to develop further. And one of the Iranian officials actually said that Russia should learn from Iran about how to navigate the sanctions, how to survive the sanctions, how to avoid the sanctions. And I believe the statement used was Russia shouldn't take a decade to learn how to evolve in such conditions. They should just take a year to learn from Iran. So there's a lot that Russia can pick up from Iran. But of course, the intensity of sanctions against Iran until now was different than the sanctions that were imposed on Russia proper. But even there, Russia can probably learn from Iran, especially when it comes to acquiring certain technologies and systems, which are civilian or dual use that could be repurposed for the military. Iran has become very successful in doing so, as the recent findings and reports have found out. And of course, Russia is seeking to acquire certain technologies and systems for use in its weapons, for use in its drones, for use in its weapons writ large. And Iran offers an example of how to do that.
What are the options for the U.S. and its European allies to try to constrain this growing cooperation between Iran and Russia?
Well, I'm not an expert on sanctions per se, and I'm not an expert on Iran specifically, because a lot of future U.S. actions will depend on the ones already taken against Iran. But this relationship between Moscow and Tehran offers a very interesting lesson for the global community. When two countries which find themselves on the same side of the fence when it comes to countering Western and American interests come together to share their common experience and to share how to navigate this new environment, how to avoid the sanctions altogether. And again, I think in many ways, Iran has a lot to offer Russia, but Russia probably has a lot to offer Iran also, like cash payments, like examples of captured equipment, and the prospect of long-term relationship where Iran can keep getting payments and other ways of payment for its cooperation and transfer of technology to Russia.
Well, Sam Bendett, adjunct senior fellow for the Center for a New American Security, speaking to us from the Washington, D.C. area. Thank you so much for giving us that analysis on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
Iran's growing military relationship with Russia is one issue that the Biden administration said it discussed last month with Israel, a key U.S. ally. Israel has long viewed Iran as an existential threat because of Tehran's frequent calls to destroy the Jewish state. Just before leaving office last week, Israel's then-Defense Minister Benny Gantz told Air Force cadets that in 2 to 3 years, they may have to strike Iranian nuclear sites that could be used to make bombs. Tehran denies seeking nuclear weapons. Gantz's warning came one day before Benjamin Netanyahu returned to the post of Israeli Prime Minister, vowing his top priority will be to block Iran. How will Netanyahu's government do that compared to its predecessor? I asked Washington-based analyst Shoshana Bryan of the Jewish Policy Center in a call last week.
I expected to react exactly the same way. As you know, as anybody who watches Israel knows, the two governments are very different in almost every aspect, outgoing and incoming. The one thing they agree on to the letter is Iran. There will be no changes in the role of Iran as the primary concern, security concern for the government.
What has Israel been doing beyond these verbal warnings in recent days and weeks to prepare for a potential military strike on Iran?
Well, it's not just days and weeks. Israel has had a series of activities that take place inside of Iran. They don't take credit for all of them. Many things are ascribed to them, having to do with power plants blowing up, other facilities blowing up, cyber attacks. So things have been going on for a very long time. However, since Israel moved to U.S. CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, from the U.S. European Command in 2021, there's been a lot more joint activity between our military, Israel's military, and the countries of the Abraham Accords, and a few others that make the Iranians nervous. So you can see now that Israel has moved from a bilateral set of operations against Iran to a multilateral set of potential operations against Iran, including, by the way, one that really gave the Iranians hives, and that is in November. The U.S. Air Force in CENTCOM and the Israeli Air Force practiced a aerial refueling and fighter escort drill that could very easily be seen by the Iranians as a way for the United States and Israel to attack Iran together. Interestingly, they did that drill in the Mediterranean Sea, not in the Red Sea. They did it outside of CENTCOM's area of operations, maybe to prevent the Iranians from attacking them back. But these sorts of cooperative activities tell the Iranians that the U.S. is serious, as well as the fact that Israel is serious.
Well, how do you think Iran is responding to these more serious moves on the part of Israel and its allies?
I said they're getting hives. There's not a lot they can do. Iran's reaction to what Israel does, whatever it is to go through the countries that it already controls, which is Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, a little bit Jordan, if they can, but Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and try to put precision missiles in those places in the hands of Israel's enemies. Iran's threat to Israel is if you attack us in Iran, we will have Hezbollah fire off all of those precision missiles at Israel. So Israel has taken that into account. They spent a lot of time and money destroying the transit lanes for those rockets and missiles through Syria into Lebanon. They have provided homeland defense for their own people. They've understood that the threat from Hezbollah is attached to the threat from Iran.
How do you think Israel and the U.S. are going to navigate this challenge from Iran with Netanyahu now in office on the Israeli side and Joe Biden? What is your outlook for that relationship under those two leaders?
It's getting better, actually, because what the Biden people have understood is, in fact, there is no change in Israel's position on Iran. But the drone thing has been a wake-up call for the Biden administration. First of all, the Americans discovered that not only do the drones have Western parts, but the drones have American parts. So you're finding Iranian drones in Russian hands in Europe shooting Ukrainians, and they have American parts in them. The Biden administration was horrified. They have begun an assessment of how that was possible. But they also now understand how aggressive Iran is in terms of buying and stealing Western technology. It has changed the U.S. view. In fact, even the New York Times said something about it today, about the increased cooperation with Israel. But you also saw in the last couple of months, the Biden administration bringing Israel closer into the fold. The IDF chief of staff, Aviv Kohali, who is in the last part of his tenure, came to the United States. He met with all of the senior security people in the Biden administration. And also, there have been four visits in 7 months by the U.S. CENTCOM commander, General Kirilla, to Israel. So the U.S., even if it doesn't want to say so, and even if it has concerns with Israel at different levels about different things on the subject of Iran, they have become very close. And I think they will get closer.
What is the likelihood that as Israel and the U.S. get closer to each other in terms of their strategy, that the U.S. would do something that Israeli leaders have been calling for a while, which is to completely give up the thought of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal? Netanyahu himself was a very strong opponent of that agreement. And I'm wondering, now that he is back in office, what does that mean for the fate of that nuclear deal or the JCPOA?
Just to reiterate, Netanyahu's opposition to the 2015 deal is exactly the same as Yair Lapid's opposition to the 2015 deal. Lapid didn't have an opportunity to come to the United States and lay that on the table because the deal at the moment seems to be on hiatus. President Biden himself said something strange this week. He said, the deal is over, but we're not announcing it publicly.
I think you're referring to a video in which Biden was at a political rally in November and told a couple of people that he thinks the nuclear deal is dead, but he can't say so officially or publicly. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. And that was repeated, by the way, by Rob Malley in December, who was asked the same thing. You know, is the deal dead? Did Biden say the deal was dead? They really don't want to cut it off. They don't want to say it's dead. They do have hopes that someday it will be revived. At the moment, you can't bring a deal from Iran to the United States Congress. The Iranians are killing people in the streets, young people, women. They're killing people in the streets because they take off hijabs and they want freedom and democracy. You cannot bring a deal here to the Congress and have the Congress accept the conversation. So the Biden administration knows that it can't do that. And I don't think it wants to do it anyway at the moment. So right now, Israel, Biden, Congress, CENTCOM, everybody is pretty much agreed that we are on the other side of some fence from Iran.
Well, Shoshana Brian, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C., great to have you with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
And that brings us to the end of this week's program. There's more coverage at voanews.com 24 hours a day, as well as on our social media feeds. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Iran team, as well as Michael Lippin, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller.